Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with David Halperin, a former White House speechwriter and senior policy advisor for Howard Dean, who was counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We will discuss the challenge Obama faces in reviving and reawakening the youth vote and the extent to which trying to ease the growing burden of student loans and extending health care coverage will activate the dormant student movement. Then we'll go to the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, and speak with Colin Carle, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and advisor to the Barack Obama presidential campaign, about what role foreign policy, which was barely mentioned by Romney and Ryan in Tampa, will play at the Democratic Convention. Since national security, which has traditionally been a Democratic weakness, is considered one of the president's greatest strengths, we'll look into how much it counts when jobs and the economy are on most people's minds. Then finally, with Monday's death of the right-wing Korean cult leader, the Reverend Moon, we will examine the shadowy connection of black money behind the Unification Church, which was founded with the help of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. Stephen Hassan, a former member of the Moonie cult, who is now the founder of the Freedom of Mind Resource Center, joins us to discuss how Moon and his shadowy backers help fund the Christian right in this country. Joining us now is David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress, senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian. How are you?
Pretty good. And we've spoken, of course, about student loan debt and the for-profit college racket in this country as a kind of bipartisan shame. But I wanted to sort of broaden it out a little bit, if we could, about, in general, how does the president revive that extraordinary youthful spirit that appeared back in 2008 with the promise of hope and change. The impression I get is that the student movement is somewhat dormant, and I'm wondering whether issues like student loans, and the president recently said he just recently paid off his student loans. I'm wondering how and where the president is connecting with his former base.
Well, when you do talk about young people, I just met with a group of young people this week, students who are currently in college. I was running a youth organization for many years, and now I'm not doing that. So there's a chance to get together with some young people, ask them if they were excited about the election. Not a single hand went up. So I think it is a time of uncertainty for young people, and that does hurt President Obama, who got so much of his energy and many of his votes from young people in 2008. But I do think it's not just young people across the board. This is an election where there's real risk that our American economy is going down and not necessarily coming back up. We don't have the sense that people are inspired, and there's just a lot of cynicism. I think that President Obama has done a pretty good job as president. I look at a lot of these things through the prism of whether special interests are dominating Washington or whether you're standing up to special interests and protecting people's interests. I think President Obama's done an okay job with that. I think, on the other hand, Mitt Romney is almost money in politics personified, and he's all about almost unabashedly advancing the interests of corporations and wealthy. And I think that it's hard to get excited about that message as much, and especially against the backdrop of a bad economy. But I do think that people, in my view, need to think about very hard about this election and the importance of voting. And if you want to see it as lesser of two evils, you can. But I think, you know, if you look at, for example, Matt Taibbi's new article in Rolling Stone and many other things, Mitt Romney, it's almost like electing Gordon Gekko, the corporate raider president of the United States.
Well, I'm surprised that given the overt cynicism of Romney and Ryan, particularly the extent to which they both lie, and Romney's cynical appeal to the Republican voters in Tampa, where he made the joke that President Obama's promised to stop the oceans rising and heal the planet, and I'm going to take care of you and your family. That, of course, flies in the face of this candidate we see on stage with all of his grandchildren who will clearly be affected by global warming. And I would have thought that, you know, a lot of young people today must be concerned about the environment. Again, what's the disconnect between the overt cynicism expressed by Ryan and Romney and the young vote nowadays far more cynical?
I think young people want a job, want to believe that they can get a job when they get out of college, they don't have to go back and live with their parents. I think Mitt Romney actually made that comment, that it would be a sad thing for young people to have to move in with their parents. And they're looking for the candidate who can get them out of their parents' house and into the kind of careers and futures that their parents had when they were growing up, or even seeing their parents feeling restored to a sense that they can have to get their careers back on track. So I think that in some ways ideology goes away when you're facing these hard economic times. My message is that many of our economic problems could be solved if, in fact, we had a leader who could stand up to the lobbyists who dominate Washington right now on issues like health care, the environment, education, and say that, for example, leaders say they're conservatives, but then they engage in things like we've talked about, like giving $32 billion a year to for-profit colleges. Many of them are scams. So they're looking for, I think that if you had a leader who said, we're tired of this business as usual, we're not afraid of the corporations, then you actually could start to solve some of the tougher issues. When we're giving out subsidies to oil companies, it makes no sense when we have a budget crisis to be rewarding companies that are producing global warming and are making plenty of money already. So I think that standing up in a way to that, and I think the only way that's going to happen, though, is if voters stand up. If they go to the town hall meetings this fall and meetings with the big candidate debates and say, for example, do you stand with the oil companies or do you stand with a clean energy future? Do you stand with students and veterans who have been hurt by for-profit colleges, or do you want to keep standing with the for-profit colleges? The problem in Washington is that when members of Congress vote, they know the lobbyists who give the money for their campaigns are watching. They don't always think that voters are watching. And that's citizens are going to have to take a much stronger role in our democracy if we're going to solve our economic problems.
So, David Halpern, it was Paul Ryan in his speech at the Republican convention who mentioned kids staying at home and staring up at the fading posters of Obama on the wall.
Yeah, incorrect. That's right. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm just going to point out that at least the posters are still on the wall. So I mean, they may have lost interest, or he may not have rekindled the passions of 2008, but the posters are still up there. Is that to say what you've just said, David, that the President Obama needs to take off the gloves in terms of him being somewhat equivocal about Wall Street? He never really took on Wall Street, and then the Tea Party ran away with that issue. He's never really pointed out, I mean, he has, I suppose, in his ads, how much Mitt Romney is an exemplar of the 1%. But do you think that if he started to draw the clear lines that you're talking about, you're either for the oil companies or for the environment, do you think that would play?
I mean, I think it would fire up the base. There are the people who are really just looking for a job. This might not be the moment that will tip the election for Obama. I think for the people in the middle, I think he's got to give them something to believe in. You know, when you talked about the event you're doing with Lanny Davis and Michael Steele, you know, a bunch of people coming out and saying that the extremes are bad, the middle is good. Those guys are corporate lobbyists. We covered an event recently in D.C. by the Bipartisan Policy Center. Former members of Congress saying, what happened to moderate Democrats? All the people speaking were corporate lobbyists. Often, you know, there's nothing wrong with corporations. There's nothing wrong with capitalism as far as I'm concerned. The problem is when they take extreme positions. And I think, yeah, if Obama pointed out some of these and pinned them on Romney, like Romney saying for-profit colleges are the future, or that we should restore windfall, you know, handouts to the student loan companies that made no sense, he's just doing that because the student loan companies are also America's biggest banks. Maybe if he picked some fights on those things and highlighted that Mitt Romney really sees no problem with the government basically being in business to make capitalists more rich without worrying about the consequences for jobs, the economy, that, yeah, that could make some people a little bit more motivated to vote and maybe make some people in the middle see that Romney really is, more than any Republican candidate I can think of, just the personification of money in politics. He would say that Mr. Howell from Gilligan's Island is just kind of low rent because he didn't earn enough money. And then maybe Gordon Gekko from the movie Wall Street is in his league, but maybe not. Romney is just someone who, through his business practices, suggests to me that he wouldn't really understand the purpose of being the president. The purpose of being president is not just to make money for rich people, it's to grow our entire economy.
Well, what's always puzzled me about him is that Romney is, he's not clear about why he wants to be president, and it feels like it's all about ambition without purpose, just another, notch in the resume. But you certainly got my attention with the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm doing a week from today on searching for the center, the idea that I've got a couple of corporate lobbyists masquerading as centrists.
Go look up Lanny Davidson. Look what he's done. I mean, he represents the for-profit colleges. He represented African dictators. He's almost notorious, and he'll call me after this because he always, whenever you say anything about him, he jumps on you, and the reporters all know this. But he's basically, there's couple of New York Times and other articles that will catalog the extreme positions that he will take on behalf of clients for money. His politics, his personal politics may be great, but that's not what he does with his day job.
Right. So I've got the wrong guys there to talk about the center, because I've always understood that the center was what determines presidential elections in this country. And it's supposedly not playing much of a role in this particularly heated partisan environment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the center between what's left and what's right is necessarily, the right policy for our country. What I would like to see are more rational debates on the merits rather than what we have in Washington so often, which is the more powerful interests have more money for fancier lobbyists, TV ads running all day long on their issues, like you see now ads all the time for energy from the oil companies and the American Petroleum Institute. And you don't have actual rational, interesting debates. I think that, a lot of people on the conservative side who believe in small government would be concerned if they really knew how much John Boehner's House of Representatives is about handouts to special interests and wasting money on things that we don't need. To me, a lot of our interesting debates and important debates are not going on because everything is skewed by big money, by TV ads, and by the candidates' fear that they won't get campaign contributions they need unless they do what corporations say. And again, I love capitalism. Some of my best friends are capitalists. I've worked in private sector, but the problem is when they seek unfair advantage. It skews the process and skews the law, so it is not a level playing field for people to compete. And it's all about, the wealth runs through Washington almost rather than through, our manufacturing centers or even through Wall Street. And that's, I think, ultimately why Mitt Romney wants to be president, not just to put on his resume, but because it's the ultimate way for him to make him and his friends rich, and he thinks that's good for America, but I don't think he's looking at the details.
Well, the case that you're making, I think, David Halpern, is a very powerful case. But I guess Obama's not a populist, right? He's a centrist, or what is he?
Is a progressive, but who realizes that he's hemmed in by certain realities, such as GOP controls the House. It almost effectively controls the Senate. Even when the Democrats had a bigger margin in the Senate, it was hard to get the votes he needed for things. And that he would be, if he pushed too hard for the progressive agenda, that he would ultimately be seen as an unrealistic and failed president. So he's got to try. And again, also my critique would be, you know, there's too much cozying up to lobbyists, many of whom are Democrats, former members of his administration and the Clinton administration, lobby for extreme positions, and sometimes he gets swayed by that. But I think that President Obama at least understands what the issues and challenges are and would like to, best he could, do the right thing. And I think 25 years ago when I was growing up and first getting interested in these things, there were plenty of Republicans I would say the same thing about. At this point, I think the party has left America, and it's made up of two things, extremists and completely cynical corporate lobbyists who will do anything for money, or politicians who will do anything to suck up to the lobbyists for money, and then will someday themselves become lobbyists.
So the subject that we've discussed a lot, the for-profit college racket, David Halpern, that's the tip of this Republican notion. I know it's a bipartisan disgrace with lobbyists on both sides, but my understanding is that this is a part of essentially a Republican model about privatizing, in this case, privatizing education, where you essentially open up the treasury for a raid. Anybody can put up a shingle and say they're this, that, and the other. And, it's kind of like what Halliburton was to the jobs that the Army used to do for itself. And the state of Louisiana apparently has modeled its Department of Education reform, in quotes, on this for-profit model. They're offering up charter schools now to churches, and even for-profit businesses could form vocational training schools and essentially have indentured labor. So I see it as a kind of a part of that overall idea that the government is there to be raided by your friends, as opposed to be, as the social democracies operate in the rest of the world, or the developed world, where you pay your taxes and you get your government services.
That's right. But the thing, they call it free market. The Republicans say we like for-profit colleges, it's free market. It's not free market when 90% of the money comes from federal taxpayers. If that's going to be the case, I don't even have a problem with for-profit colleges shaking things up, competing with the private colleges and the state colleges. The problem is there are no rules. There are no rules to ensure that the money is spent on actually helping students to train and get jobs. In the absence of rules, it's what we call a race to the bottom. They're trying to please their shareholders who are watching. They have no incentive to help their students who are powerless and don't have the information they need, and they don't have to please the government because there are no rules. That's why we advocated at the beginning of the Obama administration there ought to be some rules. When the president tried to implement them, the for-profit colleges took the tax money that we provided them and hired the best lobbyist money could buy to gut the rules. What was left of the rules, they went to federal court with the most expensive lawyers in America, the ones who represented President Bush in the Bush v. Gore case, and they got the judge to invalidate the entire rule. So there are very few rules still in place, and even those rules that do exist, they figured out ways to systematically circumvent them in ways that make things even worse for students. So the $32 billion we spend a year in for-profit colleges, frankly, many of the schools are scams. A few of them are good out of that $32 billion. But it's worse than throwing the money in the river, because in the process we're ruining the lives of students who, breaking their hearts, who promised all kinds of dreams from these schools, end up often with no job. Some of the schools are good, but often with no job, and often deep in debt that can't be discharged in bankruptcy. Their lives are ruined. So that kind of cynicism is what goes on in that sector, and there are a few things as blatant as that, but there are many examples of that where things that just don't make sense for the American people are going on because of the power of lobbyists, and often these are monsters that our government has created by giving them so much tax money that they're in this position. And the notion that that kind of arrogant industry can be created and created before our eyes in Washington is something that more citizen involvement in our democracy can do something about stopping. We are going to defeat the bad for-profit colleges, and eventually, because that kind of thing just cannot stand, and we ought to be able to fight against these other special interests so that we can actually have a real democracy and a strong economy. But it takes vigilance, and it takes people taking action, making phone calls, confronting their members of Congress, writing letters to the editor, or we're not going to have real change in this country.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halperin.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress, senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment, joined by a presidential advisor to the Barack Obama presidential campaign. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, is Colin Carle, a professor in the Security Studies Program at the Edmund A. Walsh School for Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and an advisor to President Barack Obama's presidential campaign. From February 2009 to December 2011, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon. He's the author of State Scarcity and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Carle.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be with you.
And clearly from the Republican convention, both candidates, Romney and Ryan, barely mentioned national security and particularly the war in Afghanistan. It actually was mentioned by Clint Eastwood in his strange dialogue with an empty chair. But then Eastwood's reference was kind of bizarre, so asking the invisible Barack Obama whether he'd consulted with the Russians. My recollection is that it was George W. Bush who got us into the Afghan war.
Yeah, no, I mean, we live in strange times. For the first time in a generation, you have a Democratic candidate for president, Barack Obama, who, has an overwhelming advantage in the confidence of the American public when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, poll after poll suggests, and it doesn't matter how you ask the question, in terms of general confidence in foreign policy or his leadership as commander in chief, or whether you ask about specific issues like Iraq or counterterrorism. And then on the other hand, you have the Republican Party, which I think takes it for granted that they're the party that has kind of the most credibility on foreign policy and national security affairs. And you have a guy who's auditioning to be commander-in-chief, Mitt Romney, who for the first time in 60 years at a Republican convention doesn't mention an ongoing war. So we're kind of an upside-down world.
Well, but what's strange about Romney is that for all the time he's been running for president of the United States, and it's at least 10 years, he doesn't appear to have bothered to tutor himself about international relations and national security affairs. It's almost as though he feels that can be outsourced for the vice president in charge of foreign policy.
Well, but then again, he didn't compliment his ticket with anybody who has any more foreign policy experience or interest than he did. I mean, Paul Ryan was not a foreign policy guy. He's a budget guy. So Normally a president like that, a presidential nominee like that would have gone out to try to compliment the ticket. I mean, I'm not a fan of Dick Cheney, but, you know, George W. Bush went out and recognized that, you know, he had a short resume on foreign affairs, and he picked Dick Cheney to be his running mate for that reason. I think the thing that's substantively concerning, look, I mean, both Romney and Ryan are smart guys. Nobody's doubting that. But neither one of them has a lot of interest in foreign affairs, nor a lot of expertise in it. So the question then becomes, you know, who's advising them? Because the challenge was that George W. Bush didn't have a lot of experience in foreign affairs either. And, you know, people didn't pay a lot of attention to who were advising him. And as a consequence, we got, you know, some of the greatest foreign policy disasters of our generation. And it concerns me very much that something like 70% of the named advisors to Romney's campaign on foreign policy were staunch advocates of the war in Iraq. And I think, you know, this world is a dangerous and uncertain place, and I'm concerned about the direction Romney might take it, given, you know, who's whispering in his ear.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Carle, who's a professor in the Security Studies Program at the Edmund A. Wolfe School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and an advisor to the Barack Obama presidential campaign. He was a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East at the Pentagon and is talking to us from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. So at this point, it appears to be that the most prominent advisor whose fingerprints seem to be on what little we see of Romney's foreign policy is Dan Senor. He was with him in Israel when he made a less than spectacular appearance there. But there are persistent rumors coming out of, particularly in the Israeli press, that there's an impending war in Iran that could erupt with an Israeli strike on Iran before the elections. And, of course, there's a lot of speculation in the press about that. From your point of view as a foreign policy advisor to President Obama, that's got to be the greatest nightmare, isn't it? I mean, is he simply that vulnerable to being whipsawed by some event outside of his control?
You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, Romney, the candidate, has blasted President Obama's support for Israel and argued that the president's been soft on Iran. And yet, when you kind of dig below the surface, there's not a lot of there to those criticisms. And in fact, you know, Romney's stated policies on what he would do to support Israel's security or what he would do to put pressure on Iran and ensure that they don't get a nuclear weapon are basically descriptions of Obama's current policy, masquerading as criticism. As it relates to the specific possibility of an Israeli strike, you know, they've kind of been all over the place, frankly. On the way to Jerusalem, Dan Senor suggested that a President Romney would, you know, basically greenlight an Israeli strike. The candidate himself walked that back a little bit in the following day, but then his campaign had said things in the other direction. So I don't really know. It's like on a lot of these foreign policy issues, you don't really know where Romney stands. I will say that the president, President Obama, is in lockstep with the Israelis on the objective of preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and he's committed to using all instruments of national power, leaving all options on the table, even to include military force to secure that objective. He just believes that Iran is not on the verge of getting a nuclear weapon and that we still have time to pursue a peaceful diplomatic solution, which I think everybody would agree is preferable than to kind of launching the United States willy-nilly into another war in the Middle East.
So are you concerned, though, about a foreign policy incident coming out of somewhere that's going to whipsaw the entire election? I mean, there's been a history of it in the extent to which, the hostage crisis in Iran affected Jimmy Carter's re-election, and the question that the 9/11 strike affected the subsequent presidential elections. And if you can go back to 1968, where an obscure Palestinian upset with Senator Kennedy's vote on supplying aircraft to Israel killed Senator Kennedy, who would probably have been the next president. So it's almost as though, in many curious ways, that we don't necessarily control our foreign policy destiny or our even domestic destiny in terms of who gets elected. If these wild cards can happen abroad, and another example, of course, is the often stated notion that Angela Merkel holds President Obama's fate in her hands.
Well, I mean, it's true that, you know, we live in an interconnected world and we have interest all over the globe, and what happens in far-flung places can have reverberations into our economy and into our security. So I think you're right on that. I don't really feel comfortable speculating as to whether I think, you know, the specific crux of your question about whether Israel will take action prior to our election. I think that, they're making their own calculations. I don't think, frankly, that they're driven predominantly by our political calendar. I think that the Israeli leadership, for completely understandable reasons, takes the threat that Iran's nuclear program poses to them very seriously, as does the United States, as does President Obama. I think they're going to make their own decisions, and President Obama has clearly stated that, you know, Israel has the right to defend itself. But I think the president has been clear. Look, the crippling sanctions that we put in place on Iran have just been in place now for a couple of months. They're just starting to bite. There's still time to put pressure on Iran to come to the table and negotiate in good faith and come to a peaceful diplomatic solution. And so I think, you know, it would be good if we kind of all took a breath on the Iranian issue and let this play out and not make it part of our politics.
So, Colin, back to the notion then that we are in a sort of topsy-turvy world now, where traditionally the Republicans have dominated the national security portfolio, or at least they've appeared to be had a stronger suit and more public support for their performance on the national security arena. And often it's often been argued that the Democrats have been defensive, going back to the Cold War, or whether they're being too soft on the communists, which was the charge that the Republicans leveled, or I guess in the subsequent war on terror, being too soft on the terrorists. And there's no question that Karl Rove kept floating that notion, particularly about John Kerry wanting to give therapy to the terrorists, etc. That clearly has no traction with Obama, but how much is it counting, do you think?
How much is it counting in the election?
With the American people in terms of priorities and
I think there's no question that the economy is the central issue, not only, you know, in the daily lives of most individuals, but also the issue that they're most concerned about in the election. So, you know, that said, we also know that this is going to be an incredibly close election. And if 3, 4, 5% of voters are, making up their minds in part about who they think will be the most trustworthy as commander-in-chief, I think that works to Obama's advantage decisively. So, you know, I think one of the things you'll see that's a tonal difference in this year's convention in Charlotte and just in the whole campaign on national security is the Democrats aren't on the defensive. In fact, we're quite comfortable going on the offensive. We're extraordinarily proud of the president's record. You know, think of the inheritance. You know, not only did he inherit the worst economic situation since the Great Depression, he inherited two wars. A global campaign against al-Qaeda. He's ended one of those wars, as he promised to do, in Iraq. He's transitioning the effort in Afghanistan, and will end the war there by 2014. At the same time, he's shown al-Qaeda that he means business. He's done more damage to al-Qaeda senior leadership in the last 3.5 years than in any equivalent period of time since 9/11. And that's not just bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. There's a whole host of senior leaders who are no longer with us because of the president's actions. So I think it's hard for the Republicans to pigeonhole this guy as soft or hard or whatever. I mean, the truth is he's a strong, pragmatic, principled leader, and I think most Americans kind of see him as a steady hand on foreign policy and have a lot of faith in him.
So do you think then that the president is going to take the gloves off a little, not just in this arena, but just in other arenas, but let's stay with foreign policy? Surely he can make the argument that he is getting us out of wars And the other guys, both the previous guy, McCain, and the current representative of the Republicans, Mitt Romney, have on a number of occasions talked about a need to go after Iran, to go after the Assad regime in Syria, that the president is being soft on the Syrian dictator and not being tough enough on the Iranians. I think there's much of a question there that there's a difference. One guy's trying to get us out of a war and the other's party's trying to get us into wars.
You know, I think a lot of Romney's talk on foreign policy are basically these kind of vague platitudes to American greatness and exceptionalism and tough talk. And, you know, here's a little secret. You know, Democrats love the United States too. And we believe that the United States is the greatest country in the world and that we're an extraordinarily powerful source for good in the world. But, you know, you don't govern effectively simply through swagger and tough talk. I mean, we learned that on foreign policy from the previous administration, which I think most Americans judge to be pretty much the most disastrous administration in foreign policy in recent memory. So, you know, the strange thing about Governor Romney's positions is that on a lot of these positions, he talks tough, but his core substantive arguments, as far as we can tell, don't really differ much from the president, whether you're talking about Iran or you're talking about Afghanistan. So there's kind of criticism, but not really a lot of there in terms of difference with the president's position. And then there are a few places where he's laid out very clear distinctions, and in those handful of places, it's just downright scary. I mean, you know, this Cold War mentality towards Russia, declaring them as our number one geopolitical foe, you know, threats to basically start a trade war with China on day one in office, you know, the occasional bellicose rhetoric on Iran and Syria. You know, I think in those few areas where they've tried to draw sharp distinctions, the vast majority of the American public will realize that that would take us backwards to a much more confrontational posture and a very overly simplistic view of a complicated world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Colin Carl.
Sure. Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Colin Carl, who joined us from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign from February 2009 to December 2011. He was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon, and he's the author of State Scarcity and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the Intelligence Community. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the secret intelligence money behind the Reverend Moon's cult. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Stephen Hassan, one of the foremost authorities on cults and mind control and the founder of the Freedom of Mind Resource Center, Incorporated. He is a nationally certified counselor, licensed mental health counselor, and the author of three books on the subjects of cults: Combating Cult Mind Control, The Number One Guide to Protection, Rescue, and Recovery from Destructive Cults; Releasing the Bonds, Empowering People to Think for Themselves; and his latest is Freedom of Mind, Helping Loved Ones Leave Controlling People, Cults, and Beliefs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hassan.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And the Reverend Moon, of course, died on Monday at the age of 92. He had 13 children with his wife, Hakja Han Moon. They consider themselves the true parents. I believe they were your parents at one point in your life. Tell me, though, I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but let me begin with since I cover national security affairs largely, I've always understood that there was a connection with the KCIA, that's the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, and the Reverend Moon, and that he was over here funneling a lot of money, and he created this right-wing newspaper in Washington, or bought it, the Washington Times. So what can you tell us about the extent to which the Korean Intelligence Agency was involved with the Reverend Moon's cult?
So I guess I'll start by just saying that I was involved with the group for 2.5 years in the mid-70s at a fairly high level as an American, and I met with Moon personally and attended many lectures and leadership meetings with him. And at the time I was there, I didn't know anything about the Korean CIA, but I very much had been deceptively recruited by a front group into the cult, and had basically, now in retrospect, believe I had been mind-controlled or brainwashed. And it wasn't until after I got out of the group, after falling asleep at the wheel of a van and getting deprogrammed, that the 1977-1978 Congressional Subcommittee investigation took place into Korean CIA activities in the United States, and they had a number two man in the South Korean embassy defect, and an actual KCIA agent defected with the actual written plan that included Moon. And in the course of the, I believe, 18-month investigation, the final report stated that there were more than a few occasions that there were direct connections with the Korean CIA. In fact, the founder of the Korean CIA said, quote, he organized and utilized the Unification Church for use as a political tool, unquote. And the end of the investigation said this is a multinational, international conglomerate far bigger than the scope of this congressional subcommittee can possibly follow up with, and recommended an interagency task force be set up combining everything from security services to IRS to immigration, SEC, but basically nothing happened other than a few years later Moon was convicted of conspiracy to evade taxes and went to jail for 13 months.
But that didn't stop him from buying the Washington Times and maintaining his influence in right-wing circles, right?
Indeed. So, I mean, there's so much to talk about this organization. It's actually amazing to consider. I've been following them for 36 years, that they have spent an estimated $2 billion in a newspaper in our nation's capital that has never made money. The question, of course, is where the money come from. Well, we know that $1 billion could have come from one of the largest consumer fraud scams in Japanese history, what they called spiritual sales, where the Moonies would be going to people who lost loved ones and saying that they're unhappy in the spirit world and they need them to buy some Moon vase to help them elevate their status. So the Moonies got over $1 billion from that scam of tens of thousands of Japanese citizens. So some of that could have come from there, but the big speculation is, you know, where else? Interestingly, Moon met with Kim Il-sung when he was alive, and they were considered to be like blood brothers, according to...
That's the North Korean dictator, right.
Right, the head dictator, not the son who's in power, and so there's a lot of deep concerns and questions about this organization and how he had a coronation ceremony in 2004 in the Senate Office Building and his M16 gun factories in South Korea, his car arms in Worcester, Massachusetts. And, of course, the big speculation is what's going to happen now that he's dead, what's going to happen with the feuding between the sons, and nobody really knows.
Well, Stephen Hassan, his family is a bit of a train wreck. He's got 13 kids. There's been some of them have committed suicide. A lot of them have suffered estrangement, a lot of public bickering. One had a reality TV show. Do you know who's likely to take over and who really controls this? Is this still some kind of front for the Korean Central Intelligence Agency?
Oh, I have no idea if there's any active ties with any intelligence agency or has been for the last few decades since that subcommittee investigation. But it's clear that there are some very powerful, wealthy people who are in the shadows behind the Moonies, who are who may be, in fact, the puppet masters and just using this religious organization, Unification Church, is kind of a front. We're not sure. As far as who's going to take over, Moon designated his youngest son, Baihaq Jahan, to take over. And you were right, there was a lawsuit, there was wrangling, there was an attempted coup of the assets, and it remains to be seen how it all plays out. I found out this morning that they're going to have this humongous funeral service for him. They're inviting over 30,000 people to it, and I believe it's going to happen September 15th, and it remains to be seen if any heads of state come to this funeral service and what they can make of a media spectacle of it. I speculate that a lot of that effort is really for the believers, to keep them loyal or to try to keep them loyal. I've been pleased in some ways with the coverage of his death. It certainly emphasizes, things like him going to jail and the coronation ceremony and all of his money and power. But what I've been not that happy about is the short mentions of in the 70s they were thought to be doing brainwashing. Well, I got news for you. They're still doing brainwashing or mind control or undue influence, maybe the better legal term for it, as well as many other cults that are in operation today.
So Stephen Hassan, again, one of the foremost authorities on cults and mind control and the founder of the Freedom of Mind Resource Center and the author of Combating Cult Mind Control, Releasing the Bonds, and Freedom of Mind, Helping Loved Ones Leave Controlling People, Cults, and Beliefs. What is enduring, though, about the Reverend Moon's legacy and the enormous black money behind him is the extent to which he was one of the organizers of the conservative movement here in the United States, one of the incubators. He was involved with it from the early 60s with Richard Viguerie, his direct mail operation, and which then led to the political empire of Jerry Falwell and others. So give us a sense about how this religion was in many ways a front for right-wing politics.
So when the United States was wanting to withdraw from Vietnam during the height of the Cold War era and the withdrawal from Vietnam, there was a desire to try to counter what was perceived to be the communist, influence and the communist brainwashers who were influencing American youth and such. And the instability of the South Korean government, there were two coup d'etats. Park Chung-hee was installed and the Korean CIA was created with the help of the American CIA. And apparently the Moonies were used to help re-educate any South Koreans to kind of counter the brainwashing of the North Koreans. And it was later that the Moonies were given money to start groups on campuses to counter the anti-Vietnam War movement. Later, people like myself were sent to the Capitol to fast for Richard Nixon during Watergate, and very much courting the right-wing interests. You're absolutely right in terms of Moon's involvement at basically networking, milking, and funneling money to many right-wing individuals, including Jerry Falwell. I believe he gave him millions of dollars when his organization was in trouble. When the funding for the Contras happened, I think the Moonies came through to get some money. George Bush, number one, was the CIA director during the Congressional Subcommittee investigation, and Bob Boettcher, the coordinator of that committee, said that George Bush did everything possible to sabotage the Congress's subcommittee efforts. Later, George Bush was given millions of dollars to speak on behalf of Moon in the United States, Asia, and South America. And in the meantime, as they're courting the conservative movement, he's getting close to the North Korean dictator and other fascist dictators and death squad leaders. So what he was doing and how he was doing it was definitely on the dark side, in my strong opinion. And as far as his legacy goes, I can only hope that, you know, more light will be shed on the facts of everything that he has done. And frankly, I scratch my head of how we could be subsidizing this enterprise, given that it's violated so many laws over the years. And I should also add that Moon stated over and over again how democracy was satanic and God hates democracy and God wants a theocracy that's basically focused on Moon and his children, and that we should all learn Korean, which is basically the master race.
So, well, to some extent, that is the way that the North regime operates. It's not, as a lot of analysts think of it as a communist regime, but it's really more like the Imperial Japanese regime in the 1930s, in the emperor worship of the dear leader who was close to the Reverend Moon, who also enjoyed the worship of his flock as well, or probably demanded it, right? You said you were fasting on his behalf during Watergate on the steps of the White House, fasting in support of Richard Nixon. How do you get your political orders in a religious cult?
So I'll tell you another true story, and that was the week that the United Nations was voting on whether to remove troops from South Korea for human rights violations. And the Moonies set up a 7-day fast on the opposite of the United Nations, set up a front group, and I'm not sure if I can remember the whole title because it's so ridiculous, but it's something like the Japanese Wives the American Committee for Japanese Wives of North Korean Repatriates. And more or less, we were told directly by Moon not to tell anyone we were in the Moonies, that we were there for human rights only and to draw attention to how North Korea has violated human rights and therefore why South Korea needs to have United Nations troops there. And, you know, from the mind of a Moonie, we were following the Messiah who knew God's plan, who was going to build the kingdom of heaven on earth, and that this world was controlled by Satan. And because he was God's man and he could read minds and know the future, we just needed to be blindly obedient and everything would be fine. So, later, of course, when I woke up from my trance, I realized he was a liar, he was a cheat, he had illicit sex and illegitimate children, and is not to be trusted whatsoever, much less that he's sinless and, the greatest man in human history.
Just in closing, Stephen Hassan, it's hard to understand how the right wing in this country embraced this guy, except, of course, for his money, and how somebody that was so anti-American, he hated America. The Reverend Moon hated America. He hated our democracy, our tradition of individual rights and independence thought, and he also wanted to replace democracy with theocracy. Well, I suppose that's pretty much the same agenda as the religious right in this country. But how do you explain his relationship with the North Korean dictator? If he's doing all this anti-North Korean right-wing stuff in the 60s and 70s, and then he's hanging out with Kim Il-sung. So,
right. It's very difficult to explain.
Kim Jong-il, I guess it was. Kim, yes. Jong-il.
It was actually Kim Il-sung was the predecessor, I believe, and that's who he bonded with, I believe.
The original leader,
yeah.
Then. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it was the great leader, not just the,
yeah,
dear leader.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Uh-huh. Well, he talked about how God wanted to unite Korea, and it was all about uniting. Of course, he thought that the North Korean dictator needed to humble himself and get in line under him. Of course, nothing like that ever remotely happened. I can also tell you that during Bush 2 era, I went to my congressman to ask how Moon could be doing multi-million dollars of business with North Korea when it was one of the axis of evil countries, according to George Bush, too. And my congressman came back and said he has special dispensation, was the terms he used.
Mm.
So whether or not, intelligence departments wanted information of what was going on in North Korea and was using his relationship to find out what's going on, I don't know. Or whether or not Moon was playing both sides, hard to tell.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Stephen Hassan.
Thank you so much, Ian. You asked some very good questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hassan, who's one of the foremost authorities on cult and mind control and the founder of the Freedom of Mind Resource Center, Incorporated. He's a nationally certified counselor, licensed mental health counselor, and the author of three books on the subject of cults: Combating Cult Mind Control, The Number One Guide to Protection, Rescue, and Recovery from Destructive Cults; Releasing the Bonds, Empowering People to Think for Themselves; and his latest is Freedom of Mind, Helping Loved Ones Leave Controlling People, Cults, and Beliefs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.